Kerr.
Thanks, Jerry. You know, and Jerry's spot on. I came here the first time in 2005. I sat in the back row, and I was as wide-eyed and felt like I was getting fed a fire hose of information sitting back there, and I didn't know which way to turn or what I should do or anything else. But I've been here every year since. Every single year I come here. Now, after that first couple years, they voluntold me to start helping in the back of the room, made me work, occasionally fed me cookies, which was good. For a while, they made me do the introductions like Jerry. They fired me from that this year because, no, the business got too busy out there. So it's good, but it's fun. A great organization, great place to be. If this is your first year here, you should just plan on coming back next year and every year because you're always going to learn something. You're always going to meet more great people so you can do more things and get better at it. Okay? So performing notes. How many people are already investing in notes? Okay, I know about half of you already because you're buying these, which is good, which is fine. So notes are a great way to have really passive income. And we're going to talk about that, but I want to make sure you guys understand, I am not a CPA. I am not an attorney. I have not played any of them on TV. I'm a guy who's done some things. I have opinions. These have worked. If it sounds like you should consult with a professional, then you absolutely should. Okay? As you'll find out, I may not always be professional. Okay, who were the people that came to me yesterday that were looking for lunch tickets and we didn't have any? You were today. You got to wait. How many people didn't get a lunch that need a lunch? Eight people should go up there and get a lunch. How about that? That'd make it easier. Faster. Better. Exactly. See, you remember. Okay, so if you've come in here, it's because you're already a note buyer or you're already a private lender. You're curious about those things. You're interested in doing it, but you don't know how it works. Or you got a free lunch ticket and, you know, free lunch from anybody else is always a good thing. So no promises, a great lunch, just free. I have no control over that. All right, so you're here for one of those reasons. So we're going to talk about all those things. So we're talking about what performing notes are, what private lending is, and what the difference is. Now, I'm just, you know, a guy who grew up out in the country, went through the military, did my years there, and I've learned a few things. I'm not your professional presenter. I'm way better at the, here's the lectern, let's do the military lecture. On the fourth Tuesday, you know, do the military thing. So we're going to have fun with this. The key thing that I like about performing notes and why I started, as an investor, started moving towards doing notes is because as the note holder, you don't have to deal with the tenants, the toilets, the contractors, the Saturday night phone call because the furnace went out in December. You know, you're not getting all those phone calls. So it's a very hands-off investment. You know, that property owner has to deal with all of those things. Oh, the cost overrun. Oh, we took out the kitchen cabinets. There's termites in the wall. We have to replace the wall. That wasn't part of the budget. We don't deal with that. We get them paying interest. They get to deal with those problems. Of course, I do a lot of counseling with them when those problems come up and it's new to them, but that's part of what we do. And the other fun thing about it is you can do notes anywhere and from anywhere because you don't have to be physically near the property. Now, some note investors like to go out and they like to drive by every property, look at it first, you know, look, see who's working on it, check on their investments periodically and do that. And that's okay. You can do that. But it's not required. I think I said this, didn't I? I tend to do that. Get ahead of my slides. So how many people are already a private lender of some type? You're doing some of your own lending. Okay? So that's a lot of you. So you're going to really sympathize with this part of it. Because as a lender, you're out there, you're looking for deals to fund, you're trying to screen those borrowers, screen the deals, and do all that work. As a note buyer, you're working with somebody who's already done all of that for you. We're saying, hey, we've got our standards, you know what they are, we've already done that work. Here's the finished product. All you have to do is say, oh, I want this much of this note or all of this note, and you can start collecting that interest. So that's the big difference there. As a private lender, you're the one that's working. You have a small little business. You have to work in it, collect payments, and do all that. So if you're a private lender, I know you do all of these things when you go talk to a borrower, right? You're out there. You have an application. You check their credit. You look at their experience. You verify their bank accounts. You look at their tax return. You make sure they have a good track record. You verify that their experience matches up with the deal. You know, can they actually get this deal done? And as a private lender, all of you check all of that, right, every time. I see a couple of people laughing. Okay, then you have to go out there and you got to validate that the property, that it's a deal. You know, is it a rehab project? What is the cost? Is that cost accurate? Do they think the furnace and AC replacement is $15,000 or do they tell you it's $800? Okay, both are wrong. If $15,000, they need to get more quotes. At $800, you got to find out what truck it fell off of. So what we do is we're trying to make sure those things line up, they make sense. I questioned a guy recently because he had a $12,000 HVAC budget to swap out a furnace and an AC. I called him out. I was like, listen, $12,000 for this house, that ain't right. It should be, you know, closer to five or six. He's like, well, they got to do all new duct work through the crawl space. Oh, well, that makes sense. That's about right now, but why isn't it on the quote? So getting those things in there, making sure their documentation that they're getting from contractors line things up. You know, is that rehab appropriate for the project they're doing and their exit strategy? Are they trying to put granite countertops in a Section 8 rental? Or are they trying to do cheap laminate in a $750,000 flip? You know, they've got to have the right level of rehab for the right project. So that's an important thing to look at. But most importantly is, can the borrower handle the project? So I've literally had a borrower lift up a house, replace foundation walls, and set the house back down. That was not their first project. Okay? I would never let a first-time borrower do a project like that. It's just way beyond their experience level to handle. Now, on the other hand, the guy that did it, he grew up in a family that actually moved houses for a living. So they had a lot of experience in that arena. So, wait, you move houses? Okay, I guess you know how to lift them up. You can put a wall. Okay, we'll do this one. Turned out great. Great looking project when it was done. So then you've got to look at the values. So how do you determine if this property is worth what they're buying it for? How do you determine what that after repaired value is? Do you get an appraisal? Do you get a BPO? Do you pull comps? Do you just say, it looks like about $200,000? I may do that once or twice. Especially if I've already flipped a house in that neighborhood. So there's a lot of pieces that go into it. Does their exit strategy fit with their plan? Okay, if you're doing a house with an ARV of $80,000, you better have refi as a rental as a backup plan. Because that's not necessarily going to be a first-time home buyer buying a house. Especially as interest rates just jumped up now. Some of those first-time home buyers are now going to be priced out. So you've got to look at what is the plan, does it match, and what's the backup. So I've got some people right now that are refinancing houses that they bought back in November and December that were intended to be flips. But because everything changed, now all of a sudden they can't sell them because the numbers don't work anymore. So they're in the process of doing a refi, but the rental numbers work. It's still going to cash flow, not much because the rates have gone up so much, but they're at least going to be break even, and they just want to hold it for a while, wait for the market to change, and then they're going to resell it down the road. So we had that backup plan already in place because we talked it through with them before we did the loan. And we made sure they have the credit, the capacity to do that refi. So, and then there's always that occasional thing, what happens when a loan goes bad? Now, I was talking to someone last night over a nice little glass of bourbon and maybe some gin involved to somebody else. And they're telling me about a loan they did 5 years ago that they got payments for a while and all of a sudden they stopped getting payments. Now, what do you do? Do you foreclose? Do you shrug it off? Do you try to work it out? How do you handle that process? You know, I've got an established way I do things. Boom, you're having a problem? All right, let's try to get you back on track. Let's get it worked out. Let's, you know, what's the problem? Oh, your contractor fell off the roof and broke his leg. Okay, well, let's find another contractor. You know, let's go through there. we can't get you on track? Okay, well, I can't get you on track. Why don't you give me over Deed and Lieu? We can part friends, get your life back together. Come back, we'll do it again someday. Oh, you don't even want to talk to me? Great. Attorney, foreclosure, start now. So I do a lot of screening up front on people and the project. I've had my first borrower go bad in the last 5 years. So I've done between 500 and 600 loans in the last 5 years, and I'm having my first borrower go bad. I'm in the process of getting the foreclosure or deed in lieu. They're kind of waffling now. You know, it's amazing when they get foreclosure paperwork, they all of a sudden start talking. They won't call me, but at least I got a couple of emails. Progress. So we'll see what happens. So as the private lender, or us as the lender, these are those things you have to do. What's right with this deal? What's wrong with it? How's your gut feel about this deal? Is there something just, I don't know what it is, but I just don't like it. And it's okay, you can say no. We had a guy that was doing a deal in Norwood that he reached out to me. He showed up at a RIA, you know, looking for money, because that's what people do at RIAs. And he's talking about this deal. He's doing the school conversion into condos, and he has these houses, they're rented, and this and that. And it's just something I couldn't put a place on it, because the story was good, but something was off. I couldn't figure out what it was. So I drove over to Norwood. Look, here's the project. Here's this. Here's that. There's a for sale sign in the yard. He said he had this under contract. So I called the agent. No, that fell apart months ago. Interesting. But he has three houses. Hey, I own these three houses. They're all rented. Okay, I checked the deeds. He owns those houses. Great, they're all rented. Okay, the rents weren't showing up as well. I did a little checking, and they're owned by his LLC, but they're rented to him and his wife and his family. Guess who didn't get a loan? Guess who's run off to another state because there's lawsuits chasing his butt down for people who put deposits down on condos for a building he didn't own. Yeah, you can catch a video clip on that on WHIO. A lot of times borrowers are going to ask you to do a pre-approval letter so you can do that. But a lot of times we do so much screening up front, we get a lot of people coming to us, we don't even invite them to do an application because it's not a fit yet. A lot of guys, and I actually kind of applaud them for it, is they're coming in, they're trying to get a loan to do their first deal, but they've only got $2,000. Okay? If you don't have the skin in the game, I'm not lending you money. Okay? But I'll encourage them. Go join the RIA. Go learn how to wholesale. Do some other things. Build some capital up. Come back. Okay? There's a way forward. So we want to help them out with that. But once you get through all that, now you got to coordinate the closing process. You go through, you got to review the title. Is it good? Are they going to clear all those items? Is there weird restrictions on there? Those happens. Fortunately, I have a Joyce. Joyce does all that. Say hi to Joyce.
Hi, Joyce.
Joyce gets to work with all the paperwork for the borrowers. She's that input for them. So she's doing that initial review before I look at it. And it's great because she looks and says, yeah, this one's fine, this one's fine, this one's questionable, and oh my God, you've got to see this. And we just had one of those, oh my God, you have to see what this guy is doing, which was a young kid who for the last 11 months has been living on paycheck loan to paycheck loan. He makes 50 grand plus a year and lives in his parents' basement and can't live on 50 grand a year. But he wants to borrow money from me to fix a property that his dad funded to buy for him so he doesn't owe anything on it. And I'm looking like, dude, you can't afford to pay me back $500 a month because you're spending it all. You know, but his credit was good. I don't think we ever got around to pulling credit on that one. I don't think we ever got that far. But we had a little heart-to-heart counseling session, which maybe not well-received, but received. Grudgingly admitted, he's got a problem there, so we'll see. I did invite him to come back at some point in the future once he's cleaned up his personal finances, and maybe we can do a loan with him then. But at this time, No. But the asset was there. So it was an $80,000 house. He had an appraisal for it too, because he was trying to get, went somewhere else and declined him. He wanted 50 on it. $50,000 on an $80,000 house is good. However, looking at the profile, I figured the odds of me taking that back was so great that I didn't want to put the kid in a bad spot. So I told him, listen, dude, here's what you need to do. Sell the house, sell it as is, I'll send you some investors. By the way, you never mind. We'll see if we can get it sold for you, get that money out, start cleaning up your finances, start saving some money, and start going that way. So we're trying to help people out as we're doing this. Okay, and then you got to make sure they have the property insurance. They got to have property insurance. You get title insurance when you close. You always get lender's title insurance. There is no exception. You always get lender's title insurance. It's amazing how many things get missed in title. We're doing one now. The people are selling it. They've got it sold. They're trying to do the refi. They went to a title company, and the title company says, wow, we've got 17 things we have to clear. Well, we just bought it 6 months ago. The title company said it was fine. This other title company missed 17 things that they had to clear. Guess what? My lender's title insurance would have covered the note. This is why you always get lender's title insurance. And if you're in one of those areas, if you happen to be in low-lying areas like Florida, the whole state, whatever, Louisiana, flood insurance, that's something to consider. And as a lender, you got to consider, do I even want to lend in a floodplain? You don't have to. You might not. It's up to you as a lender. As a note buyer, you might see something. I might flag it, say, hey, this is in a floodplain. You might say, I ain't touching that. Or you might not care because the insurance is there. So you get those kind of choices. Then, of course, making sure the documentation is correct. The very first few private loans I did, I used the cheap attorney. The paperwork sucked. Okay? And I found out later when there were some problems that the paperwork sucked because I didn't know what I didn't know back then. So making sure you have the right paperwork to get the right things in place to cover your butt as a lender or as a note buyer. So we've put all that stuff in place for you. And then does it all line up? Does it match? Does the whole deal as a package make sense? And if it does, then you're there. Oh, wait. If you're a private lender, you still have to service the loan. You got to collect the payments. You have to do statements if they need it. You got to process draws. You got to do draw inspections. You get to counsel the borrower when things go wrong. It's all kinds of fun. So this is why, as a private lender, some people love doing all these things. They like it. They enjoy it. It's a lot of fun. But these are all those things that we do as Dayton Capital. That's what we're doing. That's part of what we go through, and that's not everything, before we ever close on a loan with somebody. Right? So as we go through and do that, once we've actually closed on it, then it becomes a note. And that's where it allows you to guys to get involved on the note side. All that front-end work is done now. The note's closed, it's signed, the mortgage is on the way to the recorder's office to get recorded. They put their down payment down. Well, the insurance is placed. We got the property insurance. We're named as additionally insured. So all that stuff is done. Now it can be passive. Now you can look at it and say, I'm getting ahead of my slides again. What can I say? So, again, I guess my point really is that being a lender, even if it's a private lender, it's an active business. It's like being your own property manager and having rental properties. It's a business. You're actively involved in it. As a note buyer, you're an investor. You get to be passive. So that's what attracted me to the note buying. The note side was why I started being a lender, was because I didn't want to chase down the contractors. I was tired of that. I was tired of having to pull permits and get septic systems to put in and do inspections and you get contractors to come back to actually finish the dirt and all the everything else that they're supposed to do. I'd much rather somebody else have fun with that. Okay? Now here's the question people ask. Why do we sell the notes? Why don't I just keep them all? Because there's way more demand than I can keep up. When I first showed up in the RIA and they found out I was doing some lending, they tapped me out in about 10 days. It didn't take long. But I had a couple guys in the RIA. Are they here? No. not in here. Okay, but they actually approached me and they saw what I was doing there and says, hey, I've got money in my IRA. Can you get it out there for me? Oh, and by the way, I don't want anybody to know that I have any money whatsoever. They cannot know who I am. Okay. We can do that. And so we talked to one of our local attorneys that I know, trust, and do very lots of good things with because he's a smart guy. And we set it up so we do a personal property trust. And that trust ended up doing two things for us. One, it allows the trust to be the closing entity, just like a land trust, if you're familiar with those. It allows the trust to be the lender, which normally it could just be Dayton Capital as the lender. But what was really important was now instead of having to do assignments on the mortgage that get recorded publicly, now I can go out there and I can break up a mortgage through the trust and we can assign the beneficial interest of the trust. That's not a public record. So you could be sitting in here and sit right here, know that you own the note, she's the borrower. Unless you tell her that you own part of that note, she will never know. So there's that privacy piece. Now the second part that was designed to do out of that trust mechanism is traditionally when you do partials on a note, you end up buying, oh, I want the first 10 payments. You get the second 30 payments. You know, how are you going to break it up? You break it up down that line like that. The problem is when you break it up down that line, you end up, someone's in first position, someone's in second position, someone's in third position, and so on down the line. If something goes bad, the person at the end of the line can get wiped out to zero. By doing it in the trust, if we have, let's say, three people on the trust as part of that mortgage, everybody shares in first position. So if we've got a $100,000 note that's originated through a trust, you can have $50,000 of it, you can have 25, and you can have 25. And if something goes bad, you're all sharing in that first position. Every month when the interest payments come out, you get 25% of it, you get 25%, you get half. So it kind of levels the playing field. So if somebody comes in and says, hey, I made my first contribution by IRA, I got $6,000. There's not a whole note you can buy for $6,000. Okay? But you can come in and say, hey, there's a $60,000 note. Can I get 10% of that? Yes, you can, and you can share in first position. So that was one of the things we were looking for. So, yeah, I'm way off my slides again. So again, performing notes are investment. So you're also going to hear talk about non-performing notes. Non-performing notes are work. They're rehab projects. If you want to do rehab projects, I probably got a couple of non-performing notes from 5 years ago I could give you. But there are rehab projects. It's an active business. We're not really going to cover that part of things. Okay? Everything we do are new notes. These are ones I've originated. If you come out to our table out there, you'll see the whiteboard where I've taped on about a dozen notes up there. Those were all originated in the last couple of weeks. Okay, so they're brand new. All the data I have for that borrower, that project, that property is current information. So you can go out there and buy seasoned notes too. And some of those will be performing and they're great. And they might have been out there 3, 4, 5 years. And now the question is, okay, all that data is old. What's it really worth today? What's going on with the borrowers? Are they still employed? Can they still make the payments? And there's those questions you have to look at. So you're taking a different type of risk buying a seasoned note versus a new note. So it changes things a bit there. And let's see, we talked about that because we do all the work. You guys collect interest. This was supposed to be a passive thing for me, by the way. It didn't work out that way. So, key things, and these are really important. One, we only lend to real estate investors. Okay, I do not lend to someone who is going to live in the property. That's a whole different market. It's also highly regulated. So, being a non-governmental regulation kind of a guy, we don't go there. But also think about it. Now I'm dealing with other business people who are out there to make a profit. They have an incentive to get this done. They're not looking for free housing to live in. They're like, I need to get this flip done. I need to get this, you know, on the market, get it sold, collect my check so I can go do another one. I need to get this finished so I can refi it, get my renter in there and start collecting rent. So it's a different mentality. It doesn't mean an owner-occupant is bad. I mean, you're all owner-occupants, or at least most of you are. But it's not the market I'm seeking. I want that people to have that business mindset. Okay? And like we said earlier, we take care of, we go through all the qualifications, the paperwork, and just make sure we do all the work. You guys are just able to collect those interest payments. Oh, by the way, did I mention we don't charge you guys anything? There's no account setup fee. There's no monthly fee. There's literally nothing. You don't have to pay for any paperwork to be filed. We take care of all of that. So when you look at a note on there and it says there's a 10% annual yield, it is a true 10% annual yield. We're not taking anything off of that for you or from you. Now, if you have an equity trust account and they charge you a quarterly fee, I am not covering that. That's on you. Okay? So if you have like an equity trust account, they're going to charge a quarterly fee and things like that. But that's them charging you. I'm not charging you that. Okay? But I'm not charging you guys anything. You guys could get that pure interest rate back, and that's why we advertise it the way we do when we put those out there. Let's see. Where are we at? Oh, yeah. Transactional funding. So hard money loans. That's what we're doing. We're doing hard money loans. They're all short term. We also do some transactional funding. Occasionally a deal will come up where I need a little help on a transactional deal. I had a couple guys call me a few months ago. They were doing a big apartment deal. They needed $2 million. That's kind of a phone a friend deal, you know? So if you're available for that, let me know. Rental loans, on rare occasions, I'll do a longer term loan on a rental property for somebody. But mostly I'm trying to steer them towards the banks and things like that. They get better terms. But sometimes it makes sense for me to do one as a private loan for somebody because of some circumstance where they can't do something else. Maybe the loan amount's just a little too low for a DSCR lender and they just went full time in real estate and the bank won't touch them for 2 years. Otherwise a great person, but they don't quite fit those bank boxes, then I might do something like that that'll be a longer-term rental loan. Those right now are running 8%. I'm probably going to bump them up a little bit to 9% on those longer-term rental loans, what the yield about will be. I write them out for a long time. But most of them are going to pay off. Unless the rates really get crazy, they're going to refi out to that cheaper loan as quickly as they can. So I put a couple out there last month as, I don't know, I think I figured 4 years or something like that. So typical hard money loan. So when I'm out there and I'm going through my process and they have passed the initial interview and done everything else, they've got to have skin in the game. They're going to put that down payment down. They're going to put down 25% of the purchase price. If they're buying it for 100 grand, they're putting down 25. If they're buying a cheap property because they're buying something in Toledo or Dayton or the other areas where it's less expensive, they're going to put down at least 15 grand. So if they're buying a property for $15,000, guess what? You're putting $15,000 down. I'll fund the rehab for you. And that'll be okay. If somebody's been around for a little while and they've done a bunch of these on that property, because I've got a couple landlords that are doing that, I'll let them do it with 12.5 down. So, but that's somebody who's done half a dozen loans with us already, and they already have a track record in that space. So we'll cut them a little break. It used to be 12.5 until I raised it to 15 when COVID hit. So we have some people that have been around since before that, so I still kind of grandfathered them in a little bit. The rehab, as long as the rehab numbers make sense, usually I'm going to fund 100% of the rehab for them. I'm going to put that in an escrow account. They don't get the money. But as they get work done, they can draw down those funds and say, hey, I got the trash out done, the demo's done, I put on the new roof, here's my invoices for $13,000, here's my photos saying everything is done. If I feel the need to go visit, I'll do so, and then we'll get that draw processed out to them. But the draws are done as work is completed. You cannot get money before the work is done. That screws up our loan to value. Because remember, the idea is, and the reason they put 25% down, if they walk out of closing, go to the job site, and get run over by a dump truck, we got to make sure we're covered. With 25% down at 75%, even if I have to go through foreclosure, we're probably going to break even. You know, well, okay, we didn't collect any interest, but we didn't lose any money either. Okay? It's not a great day, but I can live with that. Did I cover everything on there? Oh, yeah, zero down, yeah, that ain't happened. But it does happen. Zero down can happen, and you'll see an example out there. If somebody has a free and clear rental property, I can blank that in. I will accept their rental property in lieu of a cash down payment.
Oh, of course.
So we have one out there where they had enough money for the down payment, but they would have made, that would have made their working capital really small. And it was a big rehab. So more working capital is good for them. So rather than doing a $25,000, because it's a $100K purchase, a $25,000 cash down payment, they put up a $100,000 free and clear rental property. Guess who's now in a better position than they would have been had they taken the cash down payment?
You are.
Exactly. I'll do that all day long. So yes, so zero down cash is not is an option, but they're giving up equity somewhere else. They are going to have skin in the game. Every loan that I've had go bad, which actually isn't very many, the common denominator is they had no skin in the game. Every single one had that as a factor. Guess why that's no longer allowed? And once I changed that, and I changed it very quickly, I had about first 10 done, and it was one of those, you know, I was following the lead of somebody else that I don't agree with as much anymore. And I changed it. Since I changed it to, it used to be 20%, I bumped it to 25 with COVID, and actually nobody pushed back, so I've left it there. The first one, I am now in the process, one borrower has gone bad, I'm in the process of working on taking ownership of those properties. 500-600 loans, first borrower going bad. And I'm pretty sure that is 90% of the reason is doing that and following the gut check and some of the other background things we do. Because there have been people try to sneak through things with, you know, oh yeah, this money came from here, here, there, and I'm pretty good about tracking that stuff down. It's like, where'd that come from? Oh, you got a closing? Great, show me the HUD. Well, I don't have that. You know, if I look at your bank statement, that says it was a transfer from another account. Send me that account statement. Well, that's my account. Okay, would you like to clarify? Well, my dad's lending me the money to for the down payment. You know, if you had told me that up front, we might have worked something out. Now we can't work together. Because you tried hiding it. You lied to me. If you lie to me, you're done. Do not lie to me. As a borrower, you lie to me, you are done. And I have a long memory. On the other hand, if you're up front because you got skeletons in the closet and a borrower's up front with me, hey, we can talk. I have done loans in Columbus to a guy who has been convicted of murder and spent his time in jail. Loan went great. He was very up front. He showed me, hey, listen, I screwed up. I was young. I was dumb. I was running with the wrong crowd. I went to jail. I did 5-7 years. I don't remember exactly how long it was. I've been out for this many years. Here's what I've done since then. And he was very upfront about it. Here's what it is. And because he was very upfront about it, and because I was able to verify other parts of his story, it's like, yeah, I'll do that with you. And it worked out great. So again, it's about, as a lender, and you'll hear a lot of hard money lenders say this, is it's all about the asset. That's malarkey. It's about the borrower. It's all about the person. The asset never goes wrong. The person does. Okay? I don't want the asset. If I wanted another house, I would just go buy another house. It's not that hard. I want the borrower to come in, make their payments, so we can collect interest, pay it off, and go do it again. I don't want to work that hard. That's why we do notes. So the servicing, I kind of alluded to this before. We do all the servicing. So traditionally when you buy a note, you also have to cover the servicing. Or you're going to hire a servicer like Fay or Madison or some of those other ones out there who charge you $35 to $50 a month for the privilege. We've already taken care of that for you. We're taking care of all the servicing for you. You don't have to worry about it. And if you have an equity trust account, we even fill out the DOI for you. Is that simple? That's what we're doing. And I refuse to send checks. Got a little modern. So it's an ACH. So you do not get mailbox money. You get bank account money. So it comes in that way. And even on the borrower side, I suck it right out of their account on the first. First business day of the month comes out. A week later, I send the money out to the note buyers because that gives me time that if a check or a withdrawal does bounce, I have time to reach out to them and get it fixed. It does happen on occasionally, and usually I get like, oh my God, I forgot that was coming out this month. I'll go put it in there. Right. Here, give me an hour. Go take it now. It's usually the response I get out of that. So I mentioned the personal property trust, and I think I covered most of this, but just to make sure you got it. Every note that we originate gets its own trust. I don't have to record the trust with the state, so it's good. That gives you allows you to be anonymous, like I'd mentioned before. They don't know who you are unless you tell them. You can tell them, that's fine. But some people want the privacy. And you're able to do that. Give me a second. So everyone shares in that first position. We're not creating that first, second, and third. And payments come in, payments get distributed. Unless that note is performing, I am not getting paid on it. Guess who wants to keep those notes performing? We're getting a microphone. We got questions. So, I didn't mention, because I'm more of a Q&A kind of a person, I tend to keep the presentation short and allow you guys to ask lots and lots of questions. Because you guys will ask questions of things I never thought of to put into a presentation. And it's way more fun for me. And normally I only get like 30 minutes to do this, so it's designed to be a short presentation. That's why I've been rambling a little. All right, you got a question.
I just wanted to know, what was the difference between a property trust and the land trust? I mean, it should be obvious, but what really is the difference?
Not quite obvious. They are almost identical. The only difference is a land trust holds real estate. A personal property trust holds non-real estate, or in this case, a mortgage and a note. There's actually such a thing called a gun trust, which, what do you think? Owns a gun. Hang out with attorneys and give them bourbon. You learn all kinds of weird things. Kara? I'll just hand it, pass it through those guys. Or just step on Steve's toes.
So you talked about lenders, title insurance. Can you just go over the basics of the types of titles, title insurance you'd need in a closing?
So title insurance, you've got one core, which is you get basic lender's title insurance. That covers your standard carve-outs of, you know, forgery in the past, a flawed title, a bad deed, the previous title company, or we missed something. It covers those things. Then you can get endorsements on top of it that cover additional specific liabilities. So, for example, for about $150, you can get a mechanic's lien waiver. So if you're doing a loan on someone who has been working on the rehab, you might want to get that endorsement for the mechanics lien waiver. So if they have a contractor who comes back and claims they weren't paid, but they haven't filed yet, so it can't be found, you can have that specific risk covered. And there's several other endorsements like that that cover very narrow and specific risks. I've found that for us, in general, unless I see something weird, the basic lender's title policy keeps us covered quite well. You got to use the mic. They're recording the session. So unless you have the microphone, you don't get recorded.
Okay, great. So does that include, in a closing then, there would also still be like the owner's and the seller's title insurance before the lending title insurance even comes?
So it will vary by state. Okay. So you're in Michigan, not Ohio. Okay. In Ohio, they can do concurrent issue, which means you get the owner's title policy and the lender's policy issued at the same time. And typically, the lender's policy is only $100 more than the owner's policy. So it's really cheap. And so I'm going to make them get a lender's policy. It's like, yeah, just get the owner's policy, guys. It's $100.
Yep.
Okay, don't be dumb. You buy in property, get title insurance. It's simple. It's a one-time cost. It's amazing the things that have come up. Do not ever, under any circumstance, close without a title company. It's amazing how many people I've seen that got screwed over in sometimes the most well-intentioned deals because they didn't close with a title company. Go ahead, then I'll do my story.
What's the average length of time of your notes, and how much downtime is there between the first note and my money being rolled into the next note?
Okay. The note payoff times will vary. Some borrowers are very quick about getting things done. Some are going to take longer. Bigger projects will take longer. The average note pays off somewhere between 7 and 8 months. I send the list out about once a month. I'm trying to get it online now so people get access to them faster. Unfortunately, that software is highly complex and their manuals suck. So it's taking me far longer than it should. Somebody else who's a very regular note investor is actually the guy who got me started doing it this way. He tells me on the 10% yield, he averages right around 9%, including the downtime in between. So roughly a month downtime on average over a span of time. And you can verify that, Steve, with your friend. Because it's him. And the reason, and jumping backwards now on the title insurance, is I had a friend of mine buying a property from a friend of his, and he didn't want to spend the money on the title company because he was just going to take, he was getting the deed for free because there was a boatload of back taxes on it, and he was going to go rehab it, and then he said, oh, I'll get the title insurance stuff when I get the rehab done. I was like, dude, you should get it done now. Okay? And of course, he didn't listen because he's young and he knows everything already. And he came back and said, all right, hey, yeah, great. We got the thing recorded today. I gave him $5,000. He recorded it. I own it. Now, can you lend me money to do the rehab? Which title company do you use? Oh, we just went down to the courthouse and filed it there. Didn't we talk about this? So I did a quick look on the county recorder site and said, hey, by the way, you realize this mortgage is still out there, right? I know you bought the house for 50 grand and there's about 15 grand in back taxes. What about this $58,000 mortgage that hasn't been released? He goes, what? Yeah. So that caused a problem. And then we did, as we're digging into the mortgage, we found out his friend who had bought the property, the person who sold it had forged the deed to move it from the previous owner to her, and she in turn sold it. We tracked the previous owner down. She thought it was gone in sheriff sale and foreclosure. It had gone all the way to sheriff sale, but it never sold. So she had left and moved, I think she moved to Dallas, Fort Worth, somewhere down that arena, somewhere down there, because we tracked her down there. That's where the fraud person was too, was down there also. And we tracked her down there, and we were actually able to get a hold of her. She still didn't want the property. Had to do a quiet claim to get the old mortgage released. That company didn't exist anymore. Got her to sign a new deed over to my guy. His friend actually gave him most of the $5,000 back right away because he'd spent a little bit of it. And eventually, several months later, got it all cleaned up. But all that trouble could have been saved, a lot of that drama, by just getting the initial title search done, closing at a title company, and not buying the property till all those things were cleared up. That's why we always, always close at a title company. Yeah, could have been really bad. Now, there are some exceptions. I'll do some things here and there. Like, sometimes someone has a first mortgage out there and they'll need a little bit of money for something on another project, I might do a quick second out of my personal funds, out of my IRA, 401k, things like that. And we'll do a quick title look, make sure there's nothing else weird happening out there because you already had the title search done. But that little second that I do, and I never offer them to you guys because that's my risk because I didn't do title. But to me, it's a small risk because we already did that title. Now, that lender's title insurance that I got initially, that doesn't cover that little second that I might have done. So that's a risk that I'm taking. And because it's an additional risk, you will never, ever see those on the note list. Yep, let her bring the microphone over there for you. So, and speaking of risk, there is risk. It's an investment. It's not an FDIC insured account. It's not a CD. Okay? Like I said, even though I've had a really good run, I went 5 years without having to take a property back. Now I've had to borrow one bad, and I got to take a property back. Guess what? Those people who had that aren't collecting interest while it's going through that process. And that becomes important because I've got a couple people that are using HELOCs to fund the notes, and they're making money on the spread. which has been narrowing a lot since rates have gone up. So when I know people are doing that, we have this conversation. Okay, great. You got a HELOC. You got a $50,000 HELOC. And you can get it at 5%. You want to buy a note at 10, 5% free money. Great. If that note goes bad and you're not collecting those interest payments, can you still cover that HELOC payment? If the answer is no, then you should never, ever do that. If the answer is, yeah, I can do that, it's just extra leverage for me, then great, go right ahead. But understand the risk you're taking. Okay? Back in the corner.
Yeah, for that case where you had to go find the original owner because it was forged, like the deed was forged that she had transferred it or sold it or quit claim it or something like that. Like once you let her know that it was being sold, did she ask for some kind of incentive to sign to sell it?
She did not. Other people I know in other cases, other people have, but she did not ask for anything. So that was good. You got to wait for the microphones over here.
If I'm a lender and you foreclose on that property, do I have a first right of refusal to actually buy the property from you?
Yep, so what happens if I take a property back? First, everyone who's on that property will know about it, that it's coming back. When it comes back in, if you are the only person on that trust, the only person on that note, if you want the property, we'll deed it right over to you. Boom, done, simple. If there are multiple people on that note, then we say, hey guys, he'd like to buy the property right now. Let's figure out a buyout. Does anybody else want it? No. Nobody else wants it? Great. So here's the principal that's owed. Here's the interest. If we can work out the number right there, then great. We'll get it transferred right over to you that way. If you and another person are fighting over who's going to get it for how much, I'm going to raise my trustee hat and says, all right, guys, let's have fun. We'll put it out there for sale. You can bid. Everybody else can bid. And then you'll get a credit for the sale for your portion of the note towards that price. So far, it's never come up. Most people who are doing the passive side like this don't want the property. So the normal exit is get the property back, wholesale it out to somebody else, bring the money back in, let's go buy another note. But yes, the people who are on the note will get first dibs to get that property before it goes out to the general public. However, if it goes to sheriff sale, it's already at the general public. But in this case, the one I'm doing now, I'm probably going to get the deed in lieu back, cross our fingers, in which case I'll offer it up to the people first.
Okay, thank you. And one other question. You're saying that a note is considered personal property, is that correct?
Correct.
So, and if it's personal property, does that fall under, in terms of legal regulation, the Unified Commercial Code?
It's a commercial note, so it does fall under UCC, although most of UCC simply doesn't apply.
Okay, thank you.
Joy, we will eventually get to everybody. What time is it? 1:20, what time am I? I got till 2 o'clock? All right.
I just have a quick question. As far as the initial investment on the note, that basis remains intact if there's a risk? It's just insurance it's just the interest that's at risk?
There is always a risk to the principal. Okay. So let's say a property goes to sheriff sale, there was a $100,000 note on it, and it went to sheriff sale and it sold for $95,000. There's a $5,000 loss to principal that would be shared amongst all the trust, everybody that's part of that trust. So there is a risk. Because of the down payment, the risk to the principal is relatively small, but it exists. If that scares you, this is not going to be for you. The way we set it with the down payment and some of the experienced people who've been doing this, we think that if it does go bad, we're likely to get most or all the principal back and maybe some of the interest, probably not all of it. So it's going to be close to a zero-sum game. Now, of the ones I've taken back so far, because the very first few I did were not well done, I lost a couple grand on one for $100,000. I made 60 on one because that guy was stupid. And the other one was kind of a break-even. So the guy that lost, where I made 60 grand, he could have made the 60 grand. He was just being stupid. Stubborn. More stubborn than
Well, lots of people.
Hang on, let me hit a couple things on the slides and we'll do more questions. I want to make sure we don't get booted by Drew later for going too long.
Are you doing slides first?
So we look at every deal as if I am keeping that note forever myself. If I'm not willing to keep that note, I will not fund that note. It is that simple. The other thing is that every note I fund, unless it is super short, because I'll do some that are like 3 or 4 weeks for special purposes, but all the normal notes we do, every note goes out on that list. I do not cherry pick that list. I get to keep what you guys don't want. Okay? But I'm good with that because it already met my criteria. I was already willing to keep it. So I'll put it out there. You guys all get first dibs. Most times I'll send it off on the list twice. Once when it's newly originated, and then a second time the next month with the partials, anything you might left over. After that, it's all mine. So, fun stuff. I think we covered some of the... Whoa, hey. So like I said, if the risk keeps you awake at night, you need to consider whether this is what you want to do or not do. I mean, personal opinion, it's less risky than owning the house, but there is still risk. If you need funds soon, like if you got to put money to your daughter's college education in January, nope, you need it too soon. If you got 3 years before then, okay, that's fine, you got plenty of time. So always consider, is this investment money or is this money you're going to need for something? If it's investment money that it's out there to grow, then this is great. I don't want your reserve, your emergency reserve for in case your furnace goes out at home. Please do not give me that money. I don't want it. Okay? It's those things. So make sure it's appropriate for what you're doing. Okay? So as long as those things don't scare you off, then this is a good fit. It's a way to get passive income. The fun part is the funding sources. You can pull it from almost any type of account. I've got people doing it from their personal funds, their LLC, checking accounts, savings accounts, self-directed IRAs, 401ks, health savings accounts, Coverdale educational savings accounts. Anything that is self-directed can do this. So if you have still have a 401k at work, you probably can't unless you work for somebody like me. But if you have an account over at Merrill Lynch, they're not going to let you do this. But you can take part of that account, transfer it to somebody like Equity Trust or one of the other custodians, and then you can do this because they're set up for that. Okay, so it has to be self-directed. And again, exactly, this is why we do performing notes. It's passive. It's hands-off. Money just shows up. I don't have to worry about tenants calling me, contractors falling off roofs. I don't worry about, hey, my toilet backed up. Why'd your kid put Barbie down the toilet? Yes, we had one of those. You know, I don't have to deal with that drama. Okay? This is for that passive income. I can sit at home. I don't have to worry about it. I can go down to Puerto Rico, hang out with John Heyer. No payments keep coming in. I even closed 2 notes while I was down there. So we can do that. We headed off to Vegas. You can do it from out there. I face it, as a passive investor, you can be in an RV, travel across the country, pick notes off of a list, and still have that interest income coming in. That's kind of the beauty of it. Questions? We'll go back to that. Personal plug, briefly. I got invited as a guest onto a podcast recently, and they just published it out there. Two people here at the event have found it. Both of them came up to me and said, "That was great." And I'm going, I did that 3 months ago. I don't remember what I said. The only thing that impressed me about that two people came and said it was great was that one of them is a 24-year-old person who has never done a deal but is looking to get their first deal done. The other one is a 10-year veteran who just sold their 50-unit portfolio. And both of them said it was great. Now I got to go listen to it.
That's also at the booth.
Yeah. The QR codes are at the table too. Yeah, I printed it off.
Can't get the picture.
Yeah, I'm not gonna mess with Drew's thing. But yeah, I've got the sheet printed over at the table. You can swing by, take a picture there, and get it that way. All right, so that covers. Those are samples. We have sample notes posted up there. There's still some left, some partials, one full note out there still available. But that'll give you a flavor of what comes up. Okay, let's see, where you go, boom, boom, boom. Hey, there we go, questions. Now we're going to play Q&A until they kick me out of here.
You're good now?
Good.
All right, we had questions up this way. I know she's been very patient here.
Okay, this has to do with title insurance.
Okay.
I'm the trustee of a trust that owns a property when my father passed away that I'm probably going to bid on and buy. I'm a little worried about how the things are going to go because when he bought it without a closing company, and the seller was married, said she was single.
Oh, you have fun.
And the witness on the deed was the husband. And the deed said, I'm single. So there was fraud.
Yep, you might as well get that title search started now.
Yeah. And he then lease optioned it back to them, had to evict them because they owed him $20,000. Any thoughts besides just how we're going to clean that up?
Yes, two. Talk to an attorney.
Definitely.
Have the attorney talk to a good title company. There are ways to get it cleaned up.
My concern is this woman's a professional criminal in my mind.
That's entirely possible.
And she's going to try to say, well, then pay me to sign off or whatever.
Oh, no, because...
And my thought is I'm going to come back with the fraud and the eviction that
went
transferred to the trust. So therefore, okay, you want money. I will forego suing you for this if you sign this deed.
Right.
That's
which market are you in?
Dayton.
Okay, I thought it was Dayton. Call Ben Bauer.
Who?
Ben Bauer. And there's a couple of title companies that get you hooked up that have a clue, do weird stuff. Ah, that was blinding. Don't do that. Hey, look,
hi,
spots.
Darren. Yeah. For the state, they needed to close with the attorney. And what do you still expect us to go through the title company or by the insurance? Or
so if you're doing your own lending and you're in an attorney state, you can use an attorney, just have them issue title insurance. If you're buying one of our notes, we already have that all covered for you. It doesn't matter what state you're in. We're using the state's rules for wherever that note was originated. So Ohio is a title company state, so we use the title company. Things like Massachusetts is an attorney closing state. You would use an attorney. They would issue the title insurance if you're being the lender there.
NC. So.
I'm not sure about North Carolina yet. Yeah. I'm still researching North Carolina.
It's an attorney state, she's saying.
Okay, so North Carolina is an attorney state, but you still want to get that title insurance issued. Okay, that's important. Right there. I'm going to stand over here.
Thank you. Quick question. How does an investor get paid? They get paid monthly, quarterly, yearly? What's the deal?
Yes. Yeah, so the typical process is I collect the payment from the borrower on the first of the month or the first business day of the month. 1 week later, I send the payment out to the note investor. That gives me time for if there's a bounced payment for some reason, which happens once in a while, I can reach out to them, get that corrected, and try to bring that in. Now, for example, like October, the first business day of the month was the 3rd. So I pulled money from them on the 3rd. 1 week later, 7 days, the 10th, I sent all the interest payments out. So it goes out monthly. Of course, if they don't pay, it doesn't go out. Fortunately, that's a rare occurrence, but it does happen. We got one over here. I should tell Drew he should have two mics. Just for fun. Yeah, it's a big room.
How much money do you need to get started?
More is always better. No, actually, start with $5,000 or higher. And a lot of people start with 25 to 50. I had one guy jump in with $1.2 million in 2 weeks.
Wow.
He was already he already had experience in the note thing, and there were some other things going on there. So he just jumped right in. Okay? So 25 to 50 is the most common start in. I got a lot of people that are starting with 5 or 10. If you have like a brand new HSA or a CISA account where you can only put $2,000 in, we'll let you start with that. When I was young, 23, 24, I was all impressed with myself because I had saved up $2,500. And I called down to a stockbroker and I wanted to invest it in something. And they said, yeah, kid, call us when you get $10,000. All that did was just piss me off. So I got 10 grand and I never called them. But when I got to the point here where I have that opportunity to help other investors, I didn't want to put that minimum down. I want everybody to participate. I've got one person right now, they have two HSAs at 2 grand each, and they have two CISA accounts at $1,000 each. And we put them all on one note for them, even though they're very small amounts, but we're helping those accounts grow for them. And then as they have money, they contribute to them and they keep adding to it. But we already get them started by doing that. Don't send me $100. Now, once I get a lot of things automated, and if the software works the way I think it does, might get a lot more interesting with some smaller numbers and be able to do some more fun things. But not there yet. We're still doing some things, I'm going to call it manually, even though it's on the computer.
So for tax time, do you get 1099s? Or
no, it's a commercial loan. I don't have to send you a 1099 or a 1098. It is interest. You are morally obligated and by IRS rules required to report that interest, but I'm not telling them how much I gave you. However, if you ask me, I will tell you how much I gave you. New software coming on. I should be able to send an automated report that will give you an annual, hey, here's the interest you got, and then things for the year. But I'm still not going to send it to the IRS because I'm not required to. Therefore, they don't need to know.
I'm guessing we're treated like a bank, so at the end of the year, don't we have to send you something?
No.
Like some kind of amortization table or something like that?
Nope, not at all. There's a reason why. Remember earlier when I said I don't lend to owner-occupants? Owner-occupants, now you're required to do all those things. You have to do a 1098. You got to keep the amortization update. And we're interest only, so there's no amortization. All those consumer protection laws, that's where you got to do the 1098 and do those interest statements. That's why we lend to investors. We can stay solely in the business world. It's a whole different rule set when you're on the business side versus the residential consumer side. A lot of those rules and restrictions you see out there that, oh, you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't do that. Those are all consumer protection laws. I don't deal with consumers. I deal with business owners. And you can still be a business owner if it's in their personal name. They're still a business owner. They have a business. They have bought a property for investment purposes.
Do the personal property trusts each have their own bank account?
No. I do keep one common bank account for that. I've got a separate escrow account. So as a business, I have two accounts. I have an operating account that I do all my day-to-day stuff. I have an escrow account that saves all the construction rehab money and all the interest payments come into. But I track them all individually via software. But they don't have to have all separate bank accounts. Just like a property manager can have a trust account, we've replicated that same process.
Do you have any issues when, if, like for example, an insurance payout or a payout from when one of these properties sells and the title company is paying back the loan, do they want to make the payment made out to the personal property trust?
They do that. They make the payment out to me as trustee, or they make it out to Dayton Capital Partners as loan servicer. We have occasionally discussions with title companies that want to be contrarian, and then they eventually bend to my will. But yeah, the technically correct, because it is titled in the personal property trust on the mortgage. So the mortgage will say Darren Carey, trustee for the 14 Annabelle Personal Property Trust, dated November 7th, 2022. That does not fit on a check. So typically they'll make it out to Darren Carey, trustee, or because I actually have a written loan servicing agreement that says Dayton Capital is the loan servicer for that loan, I'll send them a copy of the loan servicing agreement with that long name on there. I'll send it to Dayton Capital Partners. But either way, I'd put it, the money in that same escrow account to keep it all together. Kara, way up over here. Stretch, long arms. Just let Steve hand it to her.
Thank you. So I have a question for those of us starting and say we're not doing this move at this time. Do you have tips for us on servicing our own loans or making clear instructions for payout and expectations.
Do you have 4 hours?
That ship already sailed. I'm looking to get better.
If you're just doing a couple, a magic spreadsheet does wonders. That's honestly, if you're just doing a few, there's other pieces of software. I don't know if you can still get it. There's a piece called NoteSmith that people can use to track it. Part of the reason I do all these short ones interest only is I don't have to deal with amortizations. My note says the borrower is expected to pay without getting a statement because it's a business. They are a professional. They should know what they owe and when. The payoff letter, some title companies will send you a blank form that you can fill out in lieu of a payoff letter. On the other hand, I have a template that I use that just includes all the information they need. It's this property, here's the amount they owe, here's the per diem rate, it's good through this date, we'll file the release of mortgage, here's where you send the check, here's my signature. Behind you.
I was just going to give you a quick answer. I found online a program called Amortizer. It was $50. This guy's running his own little business out of his place. And it allows you to track that. You can go in, change the date of payment, the interest rate. You can make all those, and it'll recalculate the rest of the amortization table on the fly for you. It's a real good way of tracking that.
Perfect. You can also, if you just need the amortization table without tracking payments, I believe there's an Excel template you can just download that has one of those built in. But that doesn't have the payment tracking piece of it to go with it.
My question is, how can I check which company is better, for example, your company or the same company doing the same business with different name, like verify what is performance better?
I'm not sure. Should you repeat the question? I didn't quite catch it.
Yeah, how I can trust your company, for example, to give my money to make some, you know, business with you or a different company doing the same business?
So every company is going to have a reputation. If I want to commit fraud, I can commit fraud, and you guys won't catch me until it's too late. Okay? That's just, unfortunately, for people who commit fraud, that's just the way it is. So the way to check somebody's reputation is look online, people leave comments. Talk to other people here. Talk to Connie. Talk to Steve. You know, talk to the people here that are already doing it with me. And I've been coming here for 17 years. They haven't kicked me out yet. That's a good start. Vina has standards. If you're known to do fraud or do bad things, they will eject you and ban you from coming. There are people on that list.
You know, like customer interview, you're going like 5 stars, 6 stars, 5 stars.
Only the cranky people complain. They're always, that's why reviews are usually low, except for restaurants. For some reason, happy people do that. But yeah, I can point out 3 or 4 people you can talk to that have been doing it for a year, that have been doing it with me for a while, that know me personally.
But the online private lending industry is a wild, wild west.
Yes.
So you really look at people from a basic value of private lending.
Steve, Mike, we'll go back to that in a second. Let him finish the mic. We'll bring the mic over to you.
What happens if something happens to you?
I have a wife.
How does the
if my wife is with me and something happens to both of us, we have a Ben Bauer who Joyce knows, and Ben will take over to make sure everything gets wrapped up smoothly. Ben is a local attorney. He knows his stuff. He's the one who helped me design the way some of this works and do the paperwork. So, yep, we got the what if covered. I am trying to procrastinate anything ever happening to me, by the way.
The private lending industry is everything from an RCN capital to a mom-and-pop operation. So a lot of people don't take the private lenders that they're dealing with face-to-face. They go out shopping. If you go online, you really, really, really need to know this industry before you start investing in people like that. I contacted several private lenders in the last 4 months, and some of them say, I charge no points. Okay, what's your interest rate? 10. And then after I asked them a battery of questions, $1,395 processing fee, $995 legal fee, and so when we got done, there was 5 to 6 points.
All right, so now how would you check his reputation?
Correct. A lot of that is going to be out of state. You're going to have to get an attorney. So if you're going to put out say a half a mil in a syndication, or half a mil with a private lender. It's amazing how many people are willing to spend the money to lend, but they won't police or vet the lender. Nobody asks anything about the integrity of the lender. So you have a great question,
yep.
But it's something that everybody in this room, if they're going to be a lender, their reputation should be impeccable, as well as their finances. And if you're going to go out and seek that, you should also be able to know how to do that properly. Know your numbers.
All right, so Joyce, bring that over to Connie.
Connie's over there.
Sorry. And I'm going to tell you a secret. Not really a secret, but things to do. Here's the way, and I do this for borrowers, prospective tenants. If you want to check somebody out, Google their name. Put it in quotes, Google their name. Search the county records for wherever they live. So in my case, you would search Montgomery County, Darren Carey. Go to the court system, see what pops up. He's evicted some people. Okay. And do that. Do the same thing with the company name. Okay, Dayton Capital Partners was formed in 2007. Okay, if we were shystery, there'd be a record somewhere. You should be able to find it. Connie.
I have known Darren since he started. By that I mean, didn't you buy your first property from me or something like that? It was close.
You were
that.
One of my very first super creative deals.
Yes, it was.
But it wasn't creative. The very first property.
Well, super creative works. I've known Darren a long time, and when he started this, I started going to his meetings, and I held off for a while. But I got to the point where I had enough rentals, I didn't want any more, but I wanted some other source of income. And I listened to some of what he said, and so I started out small. I started out with, what, 5,000, 4,000? It was small.
Yeah, it was 5 or 10. It was a small number.
Yeah, it was very small, and just kept going and going and going. And I can tell you the hardest thing I have had to do in dealing with Darren is figuring out how to sign on the electronic sign on the line. I am not a technical person. Darren has taken care of everything, but that is honestly the hardest thing I've had to do. And I do some in my Roth IRA with Equity Trust, and that is a bit more involved. A
couple extra steps.
Yeah, but hey, he takes care of it, and I just sit there and look and watch the money come in. So.
Yeah, honestly, I think that very first one, you came by the office and we did everything on paper by hand to get it done, to help you out.